Alrighty, so here we are at this time in this place. And I'm going to give a talk, the title of which is Step Forward Into Your Medicine. And just to give you a little sense of where that's going, it's a talk about the relationship between, how am I doing the back volume wise? You guys good? About the relationship between kind of our inner work and our outer work, right? The relationship between our spiritual practice and the path of service. So that's what the night's about, and kind of finding, bringing those two things together and living those two things and seeing how the two things are really the one thing. Right? I was taught by a teacher, Stephen Cope, who's taught here, that in this on this plane, the one thing comes to us as two. Right? The one thing comes to us as two. I know, I'll say it's going to be cryptic because it's spiritual. Right? The one thing comes to us as two. And so in our minds, there's kind of the work that the mindfulness that we bring to our community and the mindfulness that we bring to our practice, and those are the two things, but they're really one. And so that's what we're going to be talking about, and how the work that we do, the outer work and the inner work, support each other. Okay, so that's just, so you're oriented, and that's the topic. We're good. All right, so here we go. You ready? Let me see. Step forward into your medicine. Where does that come from? So in 2008, I was captivated by the campaign of Barack Obama. Truth be told, I didn't really give him much chance at the beginning, and so I wasn't paying very close attention. He wins in Iowa, and I literally go to Costa Rica without much thought about that, and did a retreat there. And I come back. I'm in an airport, and he's won in South Carolina, and there's this big to do about it. And I'm like, oh my God. I think he's gonna get the nomination. And so there's this whole year of like stunned enthusiasm. And you know, he, as history is, you know, as we, it's now history, he wins, and it's like this huge big deal. And I was inspired, and what inspired me was that he didn't need to do it. Like, he had a good life. He and Michelle had a good life. They already had done a lot of work to create a good life for themselves. They didn't have to take on the challenges. And he modeled, I mean, my parents' generation has had folks like Martin Luther King, you know. And I was always kind of jealous, you know. Muhammad Ali, you know. I was jealous of, like, wow, they had really cool people, you know. And we had... I won't name names, but our folks were a little less luster going on, and I felt like we'd had kind of a. And by the way, I belong to a very small clique of young men who had this tradition. You know, I had a mentor, and his whole thing was, when you meet the one, watch eyes on the prize with her. And so there's about four or five of us who, when we met our future partner, we would watch the Eyes on the Prize series. And so I watched that with my now wife, and I don't know why we did that, but it's a thing we did. And I know, it's pretty cool, actually. If you haven't seen the Eyes on the Prize series, you'll feel better about this story later when you see it, because it's a phenomenal PBS series on the civil rights movement, and you really see what an amazing, how our kind of parents and grandparents rolled, and it was quite something. And so I'd been feeling kind of down about, you know, wow, we're not really as cool as those guys, you know. And then along came Barack Obama, and he really gave me this feeling that people my age, because I'm about 2 years younger than him, could go above and beyond the call of duty on behalf of, just because it's the right thing to do, not for any other reason than why not, you know. And so I looked around for something to do above and beyond kind of my job was already, I was a trainer. I trained people to be yoga teachers. And so that's kind of a form of service. You know, you're training people to serve the community. But was there something above and beyond that I could do? And I hadn't worked in the addictions field. As a recovering addict, I had worked in the addictions field for 5 or 6 years full-time, and I hadn't been in that field for a while. And I was talking to another yoga teacher, Nikki Myers, who was moving from mainstream yoga to serving addicts with yoga. And it was, we were reflecting on this, and we were like, you know what, we ought to do something. Both of us were in recovery. Both of us had been teaching for a while. And we started the Yoga and Recovery Conference. And that was in, it's been 8 years. So 2009 it started. It's an annual thing. It's on the East Coast at Kripalu and on the West Coast at Esalen. And it's a very similar, you know, it's like about 100 recovering addicts coming together to practice for 5 days. And we do that a couple times a year. And the idea was to expose recovering people to many different perspectives. So it's an eclectic, we have a Kundalini teacher, we bring in folks from Spirit Rock, you know, we've had about 3 different presenters. I really want Spring to come in 2018. We bring in Dharma teachers, we bring in, we have people who are professionals with eating disorders, professionals with trauma. And so we have, it's as informed a conversation as we can around the issue of addiction. And we have as many, many different perspectives as possible represented with the staff. You follow me so far? And one of those folks is a shaman. So we bring in a shaman, you know. We're like, you know, we should probably have, you know, this is all about spiritual practice as a means to heal from addiction, to heal from trauma. We might as well have like an indigenous spiritual tradition represented, right? And so we bring in a shaman, and that's where our title comes from. So all this talk, you know, like 2008, I'm in an airport, all that was leading us to the why of the shaman. Why is the shaman in our sangha right now? We've invoked the shaman, and why is his story part of this? And because he brings a perspective that is very powerful and helpful to this group of recovering addicts every year. And so on kind of the middle of the apex of the week, he does a fire ceremony, and it's, I've been a part of it many times, but I'm always touched by a couple things I'm going to share with you. The first is, you know, so at the beginning of the ceremony, he invites the four directions. And at the end, he says, he doesn't tell the four directions what to do, you know. He says, you know, stay with us if you will, leave us if you must. And, you know, as someone, I know that most people in this room have experienced loss, you know. For me, my first loss, I was 26 years old, and my older sister died of an overdose. And then a while after that, my best friend died of his addiction. And, like, serious, wrenching, painful loss has definitely been a part of my recovery, it's not my addiction. It was only once I became sober that I started, you know, having these losses, and it shaped kind of my a loss of those I love has made me far more compassionate and far more invested in my relationships and the people that life brings me. You know, there's something about loss that has woken me up, you know, and I can't hear this shaman say, stay with us, if you will, leave us, you know, if you must, without feeling the poignancy and vulnerability of love, you know. We can't command people to stay or go, you know. Stay with me if you will, leave me if you must, you know. And he says that to the spirits who have, you know, held us as we do our work. And so I'm always touched. And he always finds a way of saying, to leave us if you must, you know. And there's also this permission that we're giving each other. You know, what I heard here a couple years ago was this statement that I will neither coerce nor abandon my experience. You know, I will neither coerce nor abandon my experience. And so as I'm sitting with my breath or whatever else comes up, I will not coerce it, and I will not abandon it. I will stay with it. And there's a way that as this teacher is speaking to the four directions, it's like, I will neither coerce you nor abandon you. You know, with me, your love is safe. you know, and I will not, stay with me if you will, you know, leave me if you must, right? I'm here unconditionally. And so you hear that, and I'm always like, now I'm like, you know, you guys had a little bit of that this morning as spring was facilitating. There's a certain, it's in Karuna, it's the quivering heart. You know, you guys had, there's some quivering hearts in the room this morning. And I had, whenever I hear this, I have a quivering heart, and you know what's going to happen next. And so he gives, you know, the four directions permission to stay or to go as they choose. And then he turns to the Sangha and he says, step forward now into your medicine, right? The circle was about a medicine that he was invoking, right? And then he turns to us and he says, step forward now into your medicine, you know, the medicine that you choose. You know, let this circle have empowered you to know what your medicine is and to have the courage to step forward into it. And this comes, you know, and it's amazing when someone is, you know, so connected to what he's teaching as this teacher that each time I hear it, I know it's coming, but I don't want it to come. You know, I want to stay in a circle a little longer. And then when it comes, I know I'm ready. You know, I know I'm ready. I know that the circle has supported me in stepping forward into my medicine. And so, you know, as you can imagine, this has been a powerful teaching to me. This idea that I could know what my medicine is and that I'm free to choose to step forward into it. It's, no one's going to push me into my medicine, you know. I'm going to step forward into it. And as the years have gone on and I've thought about this phrase, I've been struck by the power of it, because it's not just step forward into the medicine, you know, that we need to heal, you know. It's step forward into the medicine that we're meant to bring. He's encouraging us to step forward into the medicine that is ours to share with the world, you know, not just the medicine that is, you know, that I need for my healing, but step forward into the medicine you were born to bring to others, you know. Step forward into the medicine you were born to bring to others. And you're like, Roger, right? It's like, got it. And we're in like a field. There's nowhere to, you know, it's like, what? There's going to be a process before I actually bring my medicine, but, you know, we get it, you know, and so we have to then like shuffle across the grass back to our building and have a good night's sleep and get on a plane. But at some point, very soon, we'll all be bringing our medicine, right? And so I lead year-long advanced trainings with teachers, and so these are people who are already yoga teachers, and they're coming to me like, you know, oh, I need to like learn about this, I need to learn about that, I need to learn about this. And so the very first talk I give them is, this is going to be about you stepping forward into your medicine. It's not going to be about me giving you your medicine or someone else giving you. It's not how we're going to roll here, right? This is about, as you step forward in, on your healing path, you're stepping forward as a healer. And the two things happen at the same time. You know, the two things, you know, are one thing. You know, as we step forward on our healing path, we're blazing a trail for those behind us, you know. As we step into our medicine, we're coming to know, you know, the medicine that we were born to bring. And so that's the title, and that's where the title comes from. And it's kind of, you get a sense of how I feel about it. Like I've kind of known, I think, you know, many of you have been around for a while, and you know that, you know, I can't give you anything I don't have. And we kind of know this, right? I can't give you anything I don't have. So if I aspire to, you know, giving joy, I have to learn joy. If I aspire to giving equanimity, I have to learn equanimity, you know. If I want my children to have courage, I have to demonstrate courage. I have to live from courage. I can't give you anything I don't have. So it's kind of common sense. It's cool that a shaman saying this, and you know, there's the four directions, but it's really basic here, right? We cannot give anyone something we don't have. And so if we aspire to, you know, alleviating suffering, we have to learn our own way out of suffering. Each little step, right? So, you know, I thought I would talk about what I've heard in this room, which is this idea of sitting quietly and sweeping the garden. You know, I was taught that there's two elements to our practice. There's sitting quietly and sweeping the garden. And I'll kind of talk to you about where that came from like how I've lived into it and then how I enact it in my life. And the goal, the intention, is that this talk support you as you think about the relationship between, you know, what you're doing for yourself and then how you're engaging in your community and how the two things can support each other. Is that okay? We good? All right, so how did I... So long before my teacher was telling me to step forward into my medicine, I had been doing it. You know, and how did I come to do that? Well, when I was 26 years old, I got sober through the power of prayer. It actually happens. Like I was encouraged to pray, and I did, and it worked. And so on May 21st, 1990, I asked something. I have no idea what I was asking to this day. But I got down on my knees. I'd seen the Norman Rockwell paintings, and so I knew, like, that's how you pray, is you, like, get down on your knees and you put your elbows on your bed. That's all I knew about spiritual practice at the time, is I'd seen a Norman Rockwell painting, and I was up to speed, right? And so I kind of, like, got down and, like, got on I did this, because this is how it's done, right? And I prayed. And I might have had some kind of grandiose plan, but I don't remember what it was. What I did is I said, please take the pain away. And as I got up from my knees, I knew it was going to be okay. I just knew it was going to be okay. And later on, I was told that, you know, and this is apparently, it's a common phenomena in human experience, the desire was lifted. And so through that prayer, the desire to use was lifted and it hasn't come back. And about, you know, 2 days later, I'm telling my friend from this guy, Mike Ross from Arizona. I'm in the military in Germany at this time, you know, so we're two army guys. And I'm like, you know, yeah, you know, I read this blue book and it told me to pray and now I'm sober. And and Mike, who had been my drinking buddy for the last 3 years, turned to me and said, oh yeah, my uncle's been sober. He's been sober for 20 years. He still goes to meetings. And I was like, when were you going to tell me this, Mike? Right? He'd been seeing me blackout drinking for 3 years and you're telling me this now? Yeah, so he told me about the meetings thing and I'm like, thanks, Mike, but I got my blue book and my prayer. I don't need your meetings and I'm out. You know, I don't need this crap, you know? And yeah, 2 days later, I went to my first meeting and I was terrified. And so it's a long story. I mean, I'll tell a teeny bit of it. Just, I was in Germany in the army. So at my first meeting, there was two people there, you know, and Henry, who started it who made kind of crappy coffee, and this other person who I never saw again. And this guy, Henry, became my sponsor. Which is like your mentor in that world. And he and I had a very close relationship. And in that relationship, I ended up being willing to go to rehab. And I went to rehab for 6 weeks. And what those first 2 months were like, the way I described it to Spring a couple of days ago, was getting sober was like, you know, I'm asleep and I'm being rocked, you know, by this gentle rocking. And I wake up and I realize the rocking is an avalanche and I'm in it, you know? And that's like, it's literally like waking up to the awareness that you're dying of an addiction. Like and I look up and the reason I woke up is there's these guys in a helicopter with a rope. And they're yelling, wake up, you're in an avalanche. I'm like, oh my God, I am. They're like, grab this rope. Okay, I will. Right? And so my first couple of months of sobriety, there's people who are like, I don't know if I'm that bad. I don't know. And I'm like climbing up this rope. I'm like, I'm definitely that bad. I'm going up the rope. Right? And so my first couple of months of sobriety was like, I was desperate. You know, they call it the gift of desperation. I had a clear sense, like someone hovering over an avalanche, of how close to death I was when I woke up. You know, I was absolutely certain that I was like a month or two away from a very dark death. You know, and that this rope was my way out. You know, these meetings, this rehab, and so my feeling was like, how do I not die? You know, how do I use this practice to not die? I really want to know. And I had plenty of evidence of people who were not getting sober and not having good outcomes, you know, around me. And so it was like, how do I not die? And one of the things they said was, you know, you gotta reach out and connect. You gotta develop spiritual friendship. And I'm like, no way, you know. I can't like be vulnerable like that. And the other thing they said was, you know, be of service. You know, make the coffee. And I was like, well, I won't be vulnerable enough to ask someone for their phone number because that's too creepy. I don't want to ask someone for their phone number. But if I make coffee, everyone will think I'm cool, right? So, like, I'll do that, right? I can, like, be cool. I'm just not going to be vulnerable. And so, sure enough, about, you know, now I'm in Cambridge. I'm home, and I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I started making coffee, and you know what happens, right? You make coffee, you got to get... So I thought the trick was if you make coffee, you'll definitely get to that meeting because you have a responsibility. So I'm like, I get this, but I was going to meetings anyways because I'm still climbing up the rope. My first couple of years, actually my whole life of sobriety, I've never been confused about the stakes. And so I've always had a very like earnest desire to not die, you know? So I was going to meetings every day, and I figured that's what they wanted us to do, is you're a coffee maker, so you got to go to the meeting. But the coffee maker has to get there early because the coffee has to get made. It's a, you know, it's a verb, it's not a noun, you know? And so like making coffee is a process, right? So you start around 6:15 for your 7. This is old school too, so I have the big urns, you know? And I'm figuring that out, you know? You wanna see something funny, try a 26-year-old, you know, drunken dude making coffee, right? And so... So I'm making the coffee, and you know what happens next? If you're there early, people who don't know where the meetings are leave early, and they kind of find parking, and they show up at these random times. Like, if you know where the meeting is, and you're a typical addict, you get there at 7:01, right? Because you don't want to be vulnerable in any way, shape, or fashion. If you're 2 minutes early, you may have to talk to someone, so you get there at 7:01, so you can just slip in. I'm cool. I'm just here for the meeting. You know, but like the people who are brand new, like they don't even know where the meetings are. So they end up showing up at like 6:35. And the only person there is the coffee maker. And the coffee maker has been sober for 7 months and thinks he doesn't know a goddamn thing. Sorry, guys. Right? Like that, I don't know anything about sobriety. And this person walks in and she's got 3 days. And you can feel the angel of death hovering over her. Right? You can feel how close she is to the life, you know, the life to a short and, you know, hard death, right? Very close. The nearness, you know, and it's like you're awake. And it's like, hi, how are you doing? And let me tell you about sobriety and about this community and about how you're safe here and about how you can succeed here and about where the meeting is tomorrow. And about how you can get there, and about how I know someone who can help you get there, and let me help you, and let me help you, and let me help you, because you're alone for 25 minutes with someone with 3 days. You follow me? You teach what you have to learn. I feel on this path, you teach what you have to learn, and the circumstances, the conditions arise, you know, for us to teach what we have to learn. And so I was in this, you know, they gave me that job for 6 months. And it was like I was an addictions counselor, you know, every Tuesday night at Swedenborg Chapel for 6 months. And it was without fail, someone in the first week would come early. And I was the hand of AA. I was who was going to help them. Or no one was going to. Do you understand? And this is my first experience of, you know, sitting quietly and sweeping the garden, and how when I give to someone else, I'm really giving to myself, you know. And by being of service, I reinforce my own practice. It was pretty deep, right? And so, so I went along and I was still like one of their principles is first things first. And so you kind of keep an eye on your well-being, right? And you do what you need to do to stay well. You do that first and you help anyone else you're going to help, you help after. And so I kept my eyes on the prize. I knew the odds. The odds are kind of like if you make it through the first 5 years, you've got 80% chance of survival. And so I was all about like not getting through the first 5 years, you know. And I was doing my work. But pretty soon I realized that I was going to have to make a living. People weren't going to pay me to go to meetings. And so I thought about what I wanted to do for a living. And I thought about what would be the best thing. You know, that was the cool thing about losing everything. By the way, there's some good stuff there to be had in losing. We're all afraid of losing stuff, you know. But if you lose everything, it means you get to start over and kind of choose what you're going to have in your life. And so at like 27 years old, I didn't have anything. I had like two pairs of jeans, you know. I'd had a car, but I couldn't afford it, so I had a bike, you know. And I was able to decide, you know, I had a bike in Boston. That's rough duty. You know, they have like a lot of snow there. They used to, not anymore, but they used to have a lot. In the 90s, there was a lot of snow and ice, you know, and I'd ride my bike through the snow and the ice to my meetings. And I thought about what would be the most important thing. And what came to me was, and this is, you got to figure out, I'm in a theistic tradition now. And so just maybe translate the words that I'm using, you know. But this is how I was thinking. And I was like, I want to be where people are finding God, which would be to translate. I want to be where people are learning and applying the Dharma. That's what I meant. You guys okay with that? I wanted to be with that. That transition was happening where people were waking up. I want to be where people are waking up. This was my thought, you know, because the year before I'd been in rehab, and for 6 weeks I'd seen a community waking up together. And I'd seen the counselors work, and I'd seen the kind of the patients work, and I'd been like, wow, that's the juice. That's the spark. That's where I want to be. I want to be where people are waking up. I want to be where that's happening, you know? And that was like my heart's desire. So in some ways, that is neither sweeping the garden nor sitting quietly. And so I became an addictions counselor, and I'll stop there for a second. So what had happened is I'd had a practice. And in this case, it was the practice of sobriety, right? So I'd learned the tools of sobriety, and my practice had awakened my heart. You know, so I'd had a practice, and some of you guys know what that feels like. You have a practice, and it wakes up your heart. And as your heart awakens, there develops this sincere desire. You know, there's this sincere desire that kind of arises, your heart's desire, not like the first three chakras, not like what your family wants or what your friends think you should be up to or maybe what kind of your professional persona thinks you should be up to, but then there's like your heart's desire. And there's something about spiritual practice that pushes us right up into the heart chakra and we get the view from the heart, you know? And my view is like, I want to be where people are waking up. And that came from my practice, okay? I was directed by my practice to be where people are waking up. And so I literally found an expression. I had found a garden to sweep that was worthy of my heart. So my practice connected me to my heart. And I found an expression. I found a garden to sweep that was worthy of my heart. So there's the practice and there's the garden. And in between the practice and the garden is the heart, right? And so my practice awakened my heart, and I chose a garden to sweep that was worthy of my heart. You with me so far? Okay. So now I'm like, cool, I've got a garden to sweep which is worthy of my heart, you know? And I went to school, and I became an addictions counselor, and there was like, you know, you're always tested, right? So I literally was sitting in a living room in 1995 with a choice. I was being hired by a big company to go open their new facility in DC, and I'd gone to college there, and it was kind of a cool town, you know. And I was on the I was on the tail end of a rough relationship. You know how, like, when you're at the end of a relationship, leaving town feels a little better than usual, you know? And so, like, I'm like, I'm out of this town, you know? I'm going to D.C., and they were offering me, I did the math, you know? They were offering me enough money that in a year I could be debt-free. I had, like, student loans and stuff, and I was like, in a year I can be debt-free, and I'm living large in D.C., you know, and being important. And I had that job offer, and I was offered $17,000 a year to work full-time in residential treatment with adolescents. And I was like, and I chose the 17,000 working with adolescents. You know what I'm saying? And this is the power of our practice. It gives us that kind of clarity. You know, that when faced with that, we're like, I'm going to go with door number two. I'm going to go from here. You know, and so sure enough, next thing I know, and I'm like, you know, I'm working with adolescents. How bad can that be? I was in the Army. It was like the worst experience of my life. My heart's desire, right? My heart's desire. I'm going to do my heart's desire. And I'm channeling Spring right now. Right? I'm going to do my heart's desire. You know, I'm going to do my heart's desire. I got my ass kicked so bad. Like, nothing I can say. I can say that, and you think you know, but you don't. If you think I was kicked this bad and this is like the worst, it was way down here. It was like a year long. It wasn't like, yeah, the first couple months. No. A year into it, I was still like, I don't know if I can do this. It was 43 hours a week. There were 9 hour, four 9 hour shifts. Those were forever. So from 3 to midnight. You know, and then it was unbelievably difficult. Yeah, you want to have a good time. Be in a house full of traumatized teenagers at bedtime. Those kids go off, and for good reason, you know, nothing, you know, but they go off. They do not want to be contained. I'm here to contain you with my whistle. Yeah. I'm a do-gooder here to help you. Yeah, that works really good with those kids. Really good. I got some stories. So what I tell people is, you know, the heart chakra is like this. And you're like, oh, I see clearly now. And in yoga, what happens is what you do to go from the heart chakra to the fifth chakra is where you give your word to your heart, right? You make a clear commitment, And so I made a clear commitment. It's one thing to be like, yeah, I want to help people. I'm going to help people. It's another thing to take a job and be responsible and accountable. And I talk about when you go into a backbend, when you're in a heart opening pose, it's like, oh, I love you guys. And when you go into when you include the fifth chakra, all of a sudden you can't even see where you're going, right? You commit to the heart, and there's this kind of vulnerability. You know, not only can you not see where you're going, you can't see where your feet are. So you have this tendency of stepping on other people's toes by mistake. You didn't even mean to. But there's things that you learn when you commit to your heart that you can only learn by committing to your heart. You know, we have to be a learner in this lifetime. So there's lessons on the far side of that commitment. And some of them are the toes that we step on. Some of the ways that we learn wisdom is by stepping on toes. And it's crappy because it's like the worst way to learn. Anyone ever, like on your path of service, step on someone's toes? It's like the worst. You know, can you stop with your path of service? You're stepping on my toes. You suck at this. It's like, oh, sorry, I'm on my path of service. So yeah, I was on my path of service and stepping on my own toes. Literally, I had like, for those of you, just to get specific, I had like vicarious traumatization. I had all the symptoms, and it was vicarious traumatization that brought me to yoga. Like, I had had some yoga practice and some meditation practice, but I needed it because of the re-traumatization that was going on working with traumatized kids, I needed this badly. I needed to be in places like this badly. And I fortunately, on the East Coast, we had some. I went to Kapala like, give me this. Some of you may have that right now. This is like water. Please give me some sacredness. Give me some peace. Give me some adult company. Give me some clarity and sanity on my path of service. But what happens is on our path of service, when we commit to the heart, we get this new curriculum, right? And this new curriculum demands the awakening of the third eye. And I'll get back to that. And so I have my path of service, and it awakens my heart, and my heart points me in a direction. And so now I'm sweeping the garden. And I realize if I want to sweep the garden in a fashion that's congruent with my heart's desire, I'm going to have to deepen my practice. And this is the relationship between, you know, there's the practice which leads you to the garden. And if you're in the right garden, it's going to say, dude, deepen your practice. Remember, you can't give someone something you don't have. And so now you're in your garden and you're like, I need to give these people. I can see now what's needed and I don't have it yet. And so I'm going to go back to my resource, which is my practice, and I'm going to dig deeper. And so for me to sweep the garden of residential treatment, I needed a lot of yoga asana, because yoga asana is phenomenal for traumatized human beings learning how to soothe themselves. That was me. I had to learn how to self-soothe. I learned how to, like, if I had a feeling, if I had an emotion, if I had a sensation. I grew up with, like, a lot of yelling, a lot of hitting, a lot of fighting. And so when things would get scary and hard, they were just scary and hard. And there was no one holding the children or being like, hey, is this hard for you? You know? And so I had no resource for taking care of myself. If things were scary and hard, I would just kind of like freak out, you follow? And things got really scary and hard on my path of service. And what happened on a yoga mat was people were like, okay, I'd like you to inhale, and I'd like you to exhale, and I'd like you to inhale, and you're like, oh, okay. And like you exhale, oh, thank you. Now inhale. Anything else? No, you get to, you're okay. Just stay right there, you're fine. Anything else? Any responsibilities? No, just inhale. Just exhale. Later on, you can lie down. Oh, good. You understand? And literally, this, I think that I got at maybe 30, 32 what I needed when I was one. You know, I was like, they're like, okay, it's okay. It's okay. You know that feeling you go to yoga and they're like, oh, it's okay. It's okay. We literally had like carpets and cushions. I didn't go to that hard yoga. We had like carpets and cushions. And it's okay. It's okay. You want to be on a path of service. It's okay, you know. And I needed it badly. I'm like, thank you. Thank you. Yes, yes. Okay, I'll lie down now. Thank you. I'm being like a man of courage and dignity, but right now I need to just rest, you know? And so that was yoga for me. It wasn't what's weird is it really wasn't about waking up. It was about like feeling safe and feeling at ease, you know, so that I could keep moving, you know, on my path of service. I had committed to my heart. I wasn't backing down. There was something that was going to break. Either I was going to break or I was going to break through. I needed a new way of being. And so yoga provided me with that. And so my path of service brought me deeper into my practice. And so I had my sobriety practice, which is kind of a neck up practice. And then I included the body, you know. And that led me in a whole new direction. And through the practice of yoga, I became a yoga teacher. And so now I'm in this new, you know, I'm in this new garden, and it was all cool. Like, so I had a nice, by the way, this isn't all about, like, you know, crises, right? So I had this nice period, probably like 98 to 2003. Everything's going fine. I'm like teaching yoga, and I'm practicing yoga, and I'm like, I got this thing licked. And then my daughter was born. And so I'd learned the sobriety. So now I'm sweeping a whole new garden, right? So my heart had led me to my wife, and to being a householder, right? And to raising a family. And so we bring home this baby, right? sure enough, I wasn't ready for the garden. You know, we bring home this baby, and I knew for a fact that I wasn't ready to. The thing of what I wasn't ready for were two things. Like one, the presenting issue was I wasn't ready to negotiate. If you're a parent, it's like, okay, so Dylan has to go here and Jasmine has to go there. Now, you'll do the thing at 10 and I'll do the thing at 11 and you kind of negotiate everything. Okay, I'll make the dinner and you'll do the dishes. Everything's a negotiation. Like everything. Those of you, a lot of you probably know this, right? Okay, so who's doing the thing at 11? Who's doing the thing at 12? Okay, I'm going to do the thing at 1. Okay, you're going to do that, and I'm going to do this. We have to drop off this, and I'm going to do that. And we have, like, lists and papers. And literally, in the dining room, in the kitchen, there's, like, a list, like, of parental duties, you know, for the day. And it never goes away. There's no, like, end to that. And hovering behind the list is the dishes, which are never clean, you know? And so it's just this ongoing negotiation, and that's now. Bringing home the baby in some ways isn't half as hard as it is today in terms of like just tasks to have to be performed. But I could already see, you know, like my daughter was like 2 days old, and I'm like, it's another day. And I had a spin bike, you know. I like to do cardio before I did my yoga, you know. It's like another day. Can I do my spinning? Get my spinning on? Get the music? Get the time. Then I'm going to get on my yoga mat. I'm going to do my yoga. This is how I prepare to sweep my garden. Because my garden is this yoga studio, right? So I'm like heading across the room to go to prepare for my garden, you know. I'm sitting quietly and I'm sweeping the garden. I'm heading over. My wife is like, hey, can you hold the baby while I shower? And I'm like, hey, what? What? No, I have a plan to take care of myself. I need to sit quietly so I can sweep my garden. And my wife and baby were like, you got a new garden, dude. This is the garden right here. This is your garden now. This is your garden now. That was your garden. Now that is now your like day off. When we tell you you can go to your yoga, that'll be your day off. This is your garden now. And I was not ready. I was no more ready for that garden than I was for the last one, you know. The first days in the garden aren't like, you know, aren't what we'd hoped. But fortunately, that summer, a friend of mine went to IMS with Sharon Salzberg. You know, he was there for like a 10-day meta retreat, and he called me up right afterwards and was just like, dude, you know, he's from Southern California. He's from where is that? Surfer town in Southern California where the Self-Realization Fellowship is. So you guys can't speak, it's too bad. But it's that place, the cool town in Southern California. Encinitas, yeah. He's like, dude. It's awesome, awesome, dude. Oh, so good. Oh, I was meditating. Oh. And I'm like, that sounds really good, actually. I'm not a surfer yet, but I'm like, I get it, you know. And sure enough, so there's like this thing, I think, that happens, this law of attraction, right, when our heart's in the right place. And so now I'm in this garden and I have no tools, and I attract the next right thing. I think what happens if we're in the garden for the right reasons, we get the help we need. And so literally this guy, this angel, this Southern California angel calls me up and says, dude, it's so good, sick. You just meditate, it's awesome. That's how I actually talk. And awesome, so sick. But he meant it, like Sharon Salzberg was the jam, you know. And so, I was in samadhi the whole time. I'm like, wow. I actually think that sounds way better than sucking at my new garden, right? And so I'm like, you know, I'd love to hold a baby right now, but I gotta go. I'll come back, and I'll be up to speed. It'll be great. And so that's how I made it to my first meditation retreat. You know, yeah, that was my angel. Oh, sick! He was like, yeah, that was it. And I came here. I was there, but I came to my first meditation retreat, And it was like exactly what I needed. Because, you know, one thing was, you know, the first thing is I couldn't negotiate. The way I saw things made sense to me. And the second thing was that when I brought my baby home, the only way I knew how to parent was the way my parents did. I had no idea, but when my baby came home, I became my mom dad. I wasn't my dad. I wasn't my mom. I was mom dad. And I had no intention of bringing mom dad into my new home. Like, they were not, they're welcome as grandparents. They were not welcome as parents. Their parenting style was not appropriate to what I, to my heart's desire. And so what this thing did first for me was give me some space. You know, I could have something arise. I could have my programming, and I could sit with that and look, and then I could bring the Dharma. You know, this gave me the space. My parents were yellers and hitters, and my kids have had no violence, you know, in their home. You know, no parent, no adult has laid a hand on either one of my children their entire lives. You know, they feel like safe in the presence of their parents, which I never did. I wasn't, you know. And that happened immediately because of this place. And so I'm running out of time, but what I want to say is that to wrap this up, I feel as if we need gardens that are worthy of our heart. And it doesn't have to be a professional commitment, you know. But we need gardens that are worthy of our heart. This is indispensable. By need, I mean these are deal breakers. We need a garden that inspires us to do our very best. Something that we're devoted to. So in my case, for a while, it was, you know, being a teacher. And today, it's being a husband and a father. You know, these are commitments that are inescapable to me, you know. The look on my children's face, the look on my wife's face is an inescapable commitment. Who I am in their lives is inescapable to me. It's a commitment that I choose not to waver from. And so we need gardens that are that compelling to us. And I say that because we can't leave this path. And if the garden is compelling enough, we won't leave this path, because our resource for serving in that garden is our practice, is the Dharma, is the three jewels. My resource is the three jewels, period. The way that I meet my commitment to my heart is by taking refuge in the three jewels. And by having, you know, the Buddha, the teachings and the Sangha in my life, I'm able to be the father that I want to be. I'm able to be the husband that I want to be. I'm able to be the teacher that I want to be. I'm able to perform my function in the gardens of my heart. And as far as I know, I cannot do this without my practice. This human life that I want to live is, it's not an option. I need to stay grounded and committed in my practice to have the life that I choose. But if I'm doing it just for myself, it's not enough. You know, I need, and this is yoga theory, you know, you do your practice for yourself and for others. Some days yourself is big enough, but there has to be, in my experience, something else that's going to, there's some other reason. Something else loses. If I flag in my practice, my children lose, my wife loses, my Sangha loses. If I do my best in my practice, I'm fulfilling the commitment I've made to the people in my life. And this, to me, is the relationship between the garden and the practice. And so, you know, I'm out of time. I hope I've said enough, right? But it's been important, I guess the last thing is it's been important for me to be willing to upgrade my practice, to not cling, you know, to not cling. You know, as a yoga teacher, it'd been very easy to say, look, I'm a yoga teacher, I don't need the Buddha Dharma, right? But I didn't cling. I did the right next thing, you know, the next right thing. And the same is true for our gardens. We can outgrow our gardens. And then we can start phoning in our gardens, and they no longer serve their purpose. And so we need gardens worthy of our hearts, and we need practices worthy of our intentions. All right, let's sit for a while. Allowing your sand to settle and your water to become clear. And as your sand settles, feeling into the clarity of the Sangha. Thank you so much. We have a walking period followed by 9 o'clock for sitting and chanting.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.